Morning to stand up before the church after Scotland has won at rugby again. And, it always feels better when you a slightly encouraged congregation. Somewhat ironically, we've started into this wonderful health and fitness program and just healthy living. And I've now got the second worst cold of my entire life and sort of struggling under this. So obviously the health and fitness plan is working great. And but you'll know if you were here last week, we started into the Daniel plan. This comes out of Saddleback Church in America, a man called Rick Warren, who wrote The Purpose-Driven Life. And he's designed this program. It's a study program. It's a series of DVDs, and it basically is looking at the issue of food and fitness from a Christian perspective and setting it in a wider context. And as we move forward, we're going to be looking at various subjects. You'll see next week we're going to be looking at food, for instance, and you do want to come along next week because we have Alan McKinley, who is a very well-known worship leader, probably the best worship leader in Scotland, bar our own worship team, of course. And he's coming along to lead worship. And anyone that knows Alan will know he was quite large. I don't know how much he weighed, but a lot. And he's coming to share really just how God convicted him in terms of just his whole lifestyle and things and the dramatic difference that has occurred in terms of his life. He's now like one of these former smokers. I'm told he's very zealous. So if you don't want to be too challenged about your food, maybe you don't come next week. But the music will be good. And so he's coming to talk about food next week. If we can just click on that. There we go. Then the week after that, we're going to be talking about fitness. And before we get there, I am going to have to get to spinning so I can speak with authority on the subject. And then looking at focus and friends. This week, we're adding in an additional talk in relation to finance. This isn't part of the core curriculum of the Daniel Plan, although it is actually referenced within it. We're doing this because we're studying or we're addressing the Daniel Plan as part of our stewardship month. Because every year we look at the issue of stewardship, how we use what God has given us. And it's something that we give time to each year because it's so fundamental. Because it's actually where we start to live out and put into practice our discipleship. It's great discussing theological ideas, and this week I was sitting in a library, and I came back home, and I was saying to my wife, you know, I just love sitting there, and I just get a buzz actually sitting in a library. She's looking at me as if I'm really weird and I need some help, but just sitting there thinking, ideas. Surrounded by other people engaged in kind of idea activity. I love that. But unfortunately, then you have to come back and you have to deal with the credit card bill and get the car taxed and check how things are going financially and what we're going to eat for tea. And you have to come out of that world and live in the real world. And oftentimes, Christians are a bit like that. You know, we love sitting in the world of ideas. Christianity as an idea is wonderful. It's great. Oh, it's what a brilliant idea. It is a great idea. But it's harder to actually come out and say, okay, how are we going to engage in our lifestyle? What does following Jesus look like in terms of the way that I choose to live, in the terms of the way that I choose to behave, in terms of the patterns that I adopt within my life? And that's why stewardship is such an important period for us in terms of the life of the church, because that's directly what we address. What does this look like in terms of what we embody and how we live? And right at the heart of that, and there's no getting away from it, and I know people sometimes feel uncomfortable, and I have been told that sometimes people avoid coming to church during the stewardship period because they don't like this subject. But we have to talk about finance and how we use our money. One of the things, and I actually have found this consistently to be true, that you can assess really what is happening in the life of a church and in the life of individuals in terms of the patterns of giving that you see. It's actually one of the hardest facts, objective things that you can look at and you can say, because people say, oh yeah, we're with you, oh that's great, and then disappear. But when people commit themselves financially, you actually know that they're reflecting commitment in terms of their patterns of giving. And when God begins to touch our wallets and the way that we use our finances and our Christian discipleship, it begins to get reflected in that, then we actually often see what a distinctive move of God. I remember I was part of a church when I was young, and my father was leading it, and this church was made up of young people, newly married, students, and they decided to build a new church complex. And this is in the old days when you had bank managers and things, and they began to raise money for this project. It was converting an old derelict brickworks, and the bank manager saw the amounts of money that were coming in terms of the church and for this development, and he kind of knew the people that were part of the fellowship, because you know they held other accounts, and just through conversations with my father, he converted just by the witness of how these young people were putting their discipleship into practical demonstration in terms of the commitment to the life of the local church. And so I believe it's more than just discipleship. It actually reflects our witness. You know, when we begin to look at the way that we use our finances, it begins to reflect, do we really believe in this God? Do we really trust him? One of the difficult things, and I have to be honest, I'm glad Gordon's not here. I was talking a bit about this yesterday at the gathering. You know, one of the things that I struggle with is this relationship between what it means to be called to be a church and trust in God and what that looks like in terms of all the legislation and everything that we live with. And one of the things I hate is the notion of having any kind of reserve as a church. You know, because I think, well, you know, when God comes back, Jesus comes back, he's going to like, well, why is that money in the bank? it was the Charities Commission. They told us we need 2 months reserve policy, and everybody thinks that's really sensible. And I remember when I was a younger pastor, now I understand these things, but when I was a younger pastor, yeah, I used to think, don't we believe in God? Don't we think he'll look after us? And I guess in our own personal life, there's a fine sort of balance between what does faith in God look like and what does being sensible look like. And I hate to say it, I actually think sometimes we're too safe. You know, we are a little bit too safe in terms of our finances and what we do. And maybe as church, maybe as individual, we're just sometimes a little bit too safe. And I have found that the times in my Christian experience when God has been most alive to me are those times when I've gone out and kind of been there in a place where if God doesn't come through, I'm in serious trouble. Again, another reason, I'm really glad Gordon isn't here so he can hear me talking about reserves, but the other reason I hate reserves is because they allow churches to go on in the wrong direction for way too long and allow things that are wrong in churches to persist because the giving isn't there. And so churches live on their reserves rather than address the issues. And then they find themselves so far down the wrong road that it's too late by the time that they actually do have to address things. Anyway, but we have to have reserves, so don't worry. how did I get there? Right, okay, all former treasurers and everybody in finance is going, what's wrong with this man? Right, there's a book that came out called Wealth and the Will of God. And this was a book that came out a couple of years ago. And in it, the writer begins to describe a condition that he calls affluenza. And he says this. He says, for the foreseeable future, the quality of social and cultural life will more than at any other time in history be linked to the growth in material life, both publicly and personally, nationally and internationally, I expect that the leading intellectual, emotional, and behavioral issue of the day will revolve around the detriments, the determinants, dilemmas, and dynamics of personal decision-making in an age of affluence. And he calls it affluenza. You know, one of the interesting assumptions that we make, even culturally today, is that growth is normative. Who knows that? And that economically, we will just keep on growing and growing and growing. And in order to sustain that, and this is what's happening in our culture at the moment, we have to go into debt. And so we go into endless cycles of debt to sustain endless growth. That's what our world is doing at the moment. It's what our culture is again doing. And you think from a decade ago, we would have learned a lesson that you just can't keep doing that. But because we're so committed to the notion of material growth and prosperity, and even the illusion of that, because I suggest that if we're in debt, it is an illusion. And I'm sure some of us know folks who sustain lifestyles externally, and you look at them and wow, they're doing all right, but actually it's funded by disproportionate debt that they just cannot sustain. And it's the spirit of the age. And so it's important in that kind of context that we start to ask ourselves, what does it mean to live generously? What does that look like in our culture? And other questions that we get, because while I'm talking about this affluenza, the other extreme that some Christians go to is the idea that if you have money and you enjoy it, or you go out for a nice meal, somehow that's wrong. And it used to annoy me, in fact, again, ironically, I trained in urban mission, so I trained for inner city work with the marginalized and the poor, and I've found myself leading two very prosperous middle-class churches that represent the sort of affluent end of the Christian spectrum. Don't know why that's happened, but that's where I've ended up. And it's always annoying me, particularly when I started out in ministry. I used to go to meetings in London, and I would sit there. And because I led a church that was in the suburbs, very nice, affluent part of the suburbs, and in the Greenbelt, commuter belt, everybody worked in the city, that somehow the Christians in our church weren't pauper Christians because they had affluent lifestyles. And somehow that wasn't true discipleship or following Jesus. And again, so we get into this kind of, I was talking about it last week, this dualistic kind of thought that it says anything material is bad and that to enjoy something material is bad. I don't read that in the Bible. You know, they had cars in the New Testament, and one of the disciples got a really nice car. I'm sure Jesus would have loved taking it out and going for a drive in it. And the idea of enjoying a nice meal or material things was not something that was contrary to what Jesus was about. In fact, that was one of the criticisms that was made of Jesus. You enjoy material stuff too much. You enjoy kind of eating and drinking and interacting with people. And how does that work? But again, a lot of us get into this guilt thing. If I spend money on myself, should I feel guilty? And then, should I give to everything and everyone? How do I give? I find that as I walk down the road and you get asked lots of different questions by different groups, will you give to us? Will you give to us? It's like, what do you give to? And how should you give? So it's really important that we ask ourselves this question. What does God say about money? Well, in Proverbs chapter 3, verses 9 and 10, we read these words. Honor the Lord your God with your wealth and with the best part of everything your land produces. Then he will fill your barns with grain and your vats will overflow with the finest wine. You know, whenever I give, it's saying, God, I realize all this came from you, and if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't have any money anyway. So in gratitude, realizing it all really comes from you, I give you the first and best portion. The Bible is really clear, and again, we could debate about tithing, and I have preached in these sermons before, but whether you're looking at the Old Testament or the New Testament, the Bible is really clear. It says that when you come to your money and your material resource, the first question you should be asking is, God, how do you want me to use this? That's the first question. God, how do you want me to be using this? And the principle is really clear, both in Old Testament and New Testament. We can discuss percentages or how you do that. The bottom line is that we start at that place. God, you have granted me this material prosperity, or not, as some of us find ourselves in different situations. But the question is, how do you want me to use what you have given me? And that's where we begin. And let me say, if we're not beginning with that question, we're not in a healthy place in terms of our money. The Archbishop of Canterbury has just published a book relating to money. It's actually a series of studies, for the 40 days of Lent, a series of studies on money, worth reading and looking at. But the heart of it, he says, you know, money and material things are not wrong, but the enthronement of these things in our lives is wrong. And the fact is, if we do not enthrone God and acknowledge God as our Lord, and that is reflected in the way that when we have material stuff, we acknowledge his lordship and we say, God, how do you want me to use this? Then what you will find is money will become enthroned. And money will become the Lord, which dictates to you entirely what you do and don't do. And you may still give, but actually it's from a position where money has been enthroned in your life, because your identity and who you are and your sense of worth, and really that which you honor, is so tied up with material prosperity. And for some of us as Christians, and it's scary to read a book by the Archbishop of Canterbury, not only by the Archbishop of Canterbury, but to actually ask those questions. You know, do I really ask God, as I get my monthly paycheck or whatever, God, how do I honor you with this? That's the first question. Not, oh, how are we going to pay for that holiday? Or, how are we going to afford the next car? Or what are we going to do with it? What's our response? Well, do people respond in different ways? And even to sermons like this, people immediately go defensive and they say, what I do with my money is nobody else's business. And there's a control resentment thing that immediately kicks in. I would, but I can't, and some folks aren't in a position to give, and they feel guilty and vulnerable. Others just get cynical about money, and they say they're just after my money, and it's all manipulation and control. Almost every day I have these emotions, and I'll tell you where I have these emotions. As I walk down the street past Marks and Spencer's, and for some reason, I don't know, it's designated where you go to try. In fact, there's a name for them. I've forgotten the name for them. But, sorry? Chuggers. Okay, thank you. Chuggers are all there. They're recruiting for the charities. And it's like, there's usually three of them. And you come up to that bit and you're like, okay, how do I get through here as quickly as possible? Eyes to the ground and all that. And I start to feel all these resentment things, like, why can't I walk along the street? Why are they making me feel guilty? why do I have to ignore them? I don't want to interact with them. But we generate all of these things in terms of money. But as I've said, learning to give is part of discipleship. And Paul's very clear here in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, where he's talking about the subject of giving. And he's saying, learning to give is part of discipleship. And he says, it starts with our attitude. This is what he's talking about here. He's talking about the attitude with which we approach giving. You know, we find, and in life you find different attitudes towards money. I always find it interesting watching your children's attitudes towards money and how they develop and how they're shaped and things. And you'll know some have the attitude, life is for living, money is for spending. And I have a very good friend, and he has a difficulty retaining any amount of money that he is given more than 48 hours. You know, it's like, I assume he's always thinking the world's about to end or something, so he has to go and spend it now, and then he kind of has subsistence existence until the next paycheck, and then there are others who they just don't spend anything. You go and visit them, and you're like, could we put on a little heen, please? Or you know, to put on an additional jacket. I was on holiday visiting folks, and I was in their house, and I was seeing my breath. You know, and I was like, and I was sitting there thinking, this is cold inside. Can we open the door to let it? And it's freezing outside, but it was warmer. And, you know that? And this is indicative of an attitude. It's indicative of what's going on inside. And what Paul's saying is we have to look at our attitude. And then he says this in verse 8, and he's very clear. And as a pastor, I always get a little bit worried when you read these statements, but because I would feel like a nice, clear message in tithing and, you know, give at least 10%, and that's fine. But Paul doesn't do this here. He actually stands up and he says, you know something, I'm not commanding you to give. And in fact, he actually says, you know, if your heart is not there, then I'd rather you didn't give and get your heart in the right place than you gave in a resentful fashion. You know, as a minister, and again, it's good Gordon's not here, so he can hear me saying this, but, you know, this has to be the thing in the church. You know, if you are resenting giving to the life of this church, stop giving. Don't tell Gordon I said that, all right? And get your heart into the right place before God in terms of what you're doing. Because here's the thing. One of the most effective things, and physical exercise is good, and we'll talk about that in a couple of weeks, but one of the most effective things for human happiness and well-being is actually if you live altruistically. There's all kinds of studies. Giving is so good for you. You know, it actually has health benefits, giving. And both psychologically and physically, giving is great in that sense. But you know something? If you're doing it with a resentful heart, you lose all of that. And it's true in terms of our discipleship. If we're resenting what we're doing, we're kind of sitting there going, oh no, Alistair's going to stand up and make me feel guilty again about the way I use my money. And I really wanted that car and I'm not going to give to the church, or I will give to the church, but it's really grudgingly. Then you know something? Paul says, I don't want you to give. Because we are not ultimately called or commanded to give in that sense as a kind of coercive instruction. We're called to get our hearts into a right place before God and acknowledging God for who he is. In fact, worship is about that, attributing worth to God, so that we're in a place where we attribute worth to Jesus and his work in the world through the local church, and we respond to that, and our giving is a response to that. And you see, when we do that, then giving becomes an incredibly healthy thing. The question of giving is really set in the context if we have a real love for God. And it's interesting that in this passage, he talks about a love for God and a love for one another and a love for the church. And he says, if we have a real love for God and a real love for his church, what does that look like in practical terms? You know, what does that look like? What does that mean for you? And he says, get your heart into a place so that you have a real love for God and a real love for his people. And then ask yourself, what's the practical outworking of this love? But don't start with, oh no, I better just do this. Also, can I say that it should not just be some kind of religious ritual our giving. You know, some of us just give in a very ritualistic fashion, and we kind of, and if I'm honest, I'm sometimes culpable of this, where I kind of set up the thing and think, okay, tick the box, done that, and now I don't have to worry about it. And actually, you know, it's not really an engagement. One of the things that is a troubling stat, and I don't often rebuke our church, but I'm going to rebuke you this morning, and maybe myself as well in relation to this. But we were looking at the stats in terms of, we have a gift day, and the purpose of a gift day is so that the church people can look at the way that they're living their lives overall, but they can also look at the way that they're giving to the church. And work out, what are you calling me to do, God? Is this appropriate? Is this inappropriate? Do I need to increase this? Do I need to decrease this? Does it need to stay the same? Now, we were looking at the stats of the response from last year in terms of just, because most of us are regular givers, and just looking at how many people adjusted their giving in some way in relation to that call. Now, if you ask me, how many people do you think there should be some kind of adjustment you would anticipate if we were earnestly doing that? Well, I don't know what sort of figure you would think, but you would think there'd be quite a little bit of movement you would see and things like that. The reality was that the adjustments that we're looking at in terms of that is almost less than 5% of the total givers. That's those who are giving, not the ones that aren't giving, within the life of the church. Which kind of suggests that actually maybe the people aren't really engaging with the exercise. This year, we're discussing the prospect of actually giving you a tick box that you have to reply to. And it's okay if you think it's got to stay the same or even if you've got to reduce it. But actually, for goodness sake, the call is, let's do this. You know, it's not some perfunctory religious ritual we're going through. This is actually about what's God calling you and how does God want you to practically respond. And that requires a response, a prayer and consideration in terms of it. Anyway, Paul lays out here a series of principles in terms of how we give, and we'll just quickly run through these. The context that he's talking about in 2 Corinthians 8 is a church in Judea needed help and financial support. There was a famine, I believe, going on in Judea, and there was serious financial crisis going on there. They were living under military occupation, and it was a tough place to be. It was a tough place to be church. And they had serious difficulties in terms of an agricultural failure. And so Paul said, you know, all these wealthy churches in Greece and Italy, guys, we need to get around and support our Christian brothers and sisters in Judea. And this is what Paul was doing. And so he turned to the church in Corinth. And Corinth was one of the wealthiest churches out there. We actually know this because the treasurer of the city, apparently, was a member of the congregation. He's actually referenced in one of the letters. And we have an inscription to a guy called Erastus. And it says, in Corinth. So if you get an inscription, and a wee plaque or whatever, that meant you were fairly prosperous. And it says, Erastus laid this pavement. He was paying for the roads in Corinth at his own expense in appreciation of his appointment as city treasurer. And this guy was in the church. And Paul was like, wow. And so here he's talking to a church who's got people like Erastus who can pay for the roads in Corinth. But again, he's saying to a guy like Erastus, not, you've got loads of money, it's your Christian duty to do this. He's saying, get your heart in the right place. And then it will take care of itself. And so what he does is, to encourage the church in Corinth, he holds up the example of a church in Macedonia. If we go to the next slide, Macedonia is in the north of Greece, Corinth was in the south. And there was a bit of rivalry, you know, it was a Rangers-Celtic thing, Scotland-England thing. The north and the south. So he was holding up the example of the north. And he's saying, you know, and they're poorer up there. You know, you tell us how much better you are than them. And yet this is what they did. And he shows us the example of the church in Macedonia. First of all, he says, look, they gave in a way that was proportionate according to what they had. And at, towards the end of the passage, you'll see from verse 10 onwards, he develops this idea of proportionality. What he's saying is, I don't want you to suffer necessarily, but I want you to recognize that if you have an abundance, that actually there comes a point where you should be sharing out of that abundance. And that's what they were doing. They were sharing out of that abundance. One of the most obscene things that you will see in our culture today is the attitude towards luxury yachts. I used to sometimes go down to Nice. I love staying down in Nice, and you will see all of the nice luxury yachts in the harbour down there and things. And there's a culture which is where you have these abundance, vast abundances. What do you do with it? Well, you get a big yacht, and then you buy a big yacht, and then your neighbor gets a bigger yacht. And then you think, I'm displaced and I have to go and get another yacht. And you can read about this, that actually these multimillionaires, billionaires at points, are sitting there spending as much money on these yachts. You know how many days in the year they spend on those yachts? You know, maybe a couple of weeks, max. Hundreds of millions. A competition, and it's like abundance. Now, none of us, well, I don't think any of you are there, and none of us are there, but certainly some of us do have an abundance in terms of our lives. you know, we do have a surplus of Cabo One, so all everything's paid for. We do have a surplus. And oftentimes what we do in terms of these surpluses is that we expand into the surplus. You know, I look at what I lived on 30 years ago and what I now need to live on 30 years earlier, and I go, what happened? And I expanded into the abundance. And again, God doesn't have a problem if we enjoy some of the things that he blesses us with. But he does have a problem if we neglect our love for him and our love for his church in the way that we spend that abundance. So he says this is a proportionality, but equally it works the other way. If you don't have an abundance, okay, if you're sitting here this morning, sitting there thinking, how are we going to make the mortgage payment at the end of this month? And I know there are people in our church as well sitting doing that. Sometimes it's more acute in a church like ours. You know, God is not expecting you to somehow give to the church. It's okay. It's okay that if you're in a place where you don't have abundance, then it's okay to say, God, this is where I am at the moment. And when I come into a good place, I will recognize my giving. But at the moment, it's going to be proportional. Secondly, it's sacrificial. In verses 2 and 3, he actually goes on to say, you know, what they did in Macedonia was they were willing to give up things. They were actually willing to give up things and be sacrificial in their giving. And I always hate this. And we'll talk about food next week. But, you know, it's like fasting. You kind of think, when did I actually give to the point that it really hurt? You know, most of us give, and many of us give very generously, but we don't give generously to the point that it hurts, or most of us don't. You know, when was the last time we really did that? To a point where it meant that you're going to have to defer maybe getting that bigger house for a year, or maybe changing that car, or defer that holiday. When was the last time any of us really did that? But he said that's what they did. There was a sacrificial element. And again, not that I'm commanding this, but I think our love of God and our love of church sometimes will take us to a point where we express sacrificial giving. And if it's been a long time since we've done that, maybe we should be looking at, why has it been a long time since I actually gave sacrificially? To a point where it kind of hurt. and you know where those places are. And lastly, he then talks about this, the urge to give, verse 4. There was a compulsiveness. We really want to do this. We need to invest in what God is doing. And I think that compulsiveness really addresses the other two. You know, when you get that compulsiveness, we really want to invest in the life of the local church. We really want to invest in God's work in the world. We really want to do this. Because the way he's portraying Macedonia is like they're saying, Paul, can we sign up for this? Can we give? Can we be involved? And there's a compulsiveness and an urgency in the way that they want to give. You know, this morning, I think that reflects a healthy pattern of giving. And my question is, are we expressing healthy pattern of giving? You know, are we giving proportionately? Are we really addressing that abundance issue? Or how's that abundance being used? Are we actually pushing ourselves at points to give sacrificially, where it actually hurts sometimes to write the check or to do the direct debit transfer? And are we actually compulsive in terms of our hearts, where we say, we want to be involved in this. We want to be investing in the local church. We want to be investing in what God is doing because we love our God and we love his people. Now, if we're not there, we have to start with our attitude and then work out from there. I believe if we as a people do this, then our church will not be facing financial issues or things, and we will be doing what God calls us to do because we will be financed and resourced to be doing all that he's called us. Let's pray. Lord God, we thank you for your word, and we thank you for the challenge of these verses. And Lord, I just pray that you would help each one of us to work out what this looks like in our own lives. Lord, not that there would be any sense of compulsion or guilt, but that actually, Lord, prayerfully before you, we would work out what our love for you and our love for your people look like. Lord, I just pray that if we're not there, if our attitude has shifted for whatever reason, I just pray that you would help us to be brought back to a place where we would renew that love and we would rediscover that love and it would take practical expression. I ask this in your name. Amen.